My guest today is Robert Higgs, who is a senior fellow in political economy at the Independent Institute. He is also an economics professor. He has a PhD in economics from Johns Hopkins. Now, normally a PhD in economics basically disqualifies you as knowing anything about economics because generally you get brainwashed by Keynesians, but apparently that's not the case with Mr. Higgs. He's also taught at many top universities, including, it looks like, Oxford and Stanford University. He's also authored quite a few books. The most recent two coming out in 2009, The Decline of American Liberalism and Depression, War, and the Cold War. Mr. Higgs, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to the Peter Schiff Show. And as I said earlier, this is going to be one opportunity where you and I can have a discussion where I will be the big government guy. Okay, but before we get into that discussion, let's talk a little bit about your analysis as a PhD in economics of President Obama's and maybe Bush's prescription to cure our economic ills and what the central bank is doing. And are they saving us from another Great Depression, or are they ensuring that it's going to be even worse?
Well, I think the latter answer is the correct one. I don't think that what the government has done so far, either in terms of the Treasury's actions and the Congress or the Fed's actions, have been constructive measures. They've been misdirected in the sense that they do not deal with the things that need to be dealt with to get us out of this recession.
Well, in your mind, what have they done wrong, and where are they repeating the mistakes of Hoover or Roosevelt, and what should they be doing to get a different outcome?
The main thing that's been done wrong is twofold. First of all, on the fiscal front, the current troubles have astonishingly revived what I call vulgar Keynesianism among the economists. Professional economists had more or less transcended Keynesianism back in the 1970s as a result of the stagflation experienced at that time. And they had moved on to other ways of analyzing the macroeconomy, but starting in 2008, when so many people panicked as a result of the financial debacle, it seems that many members of the economics profession also panicked and retreated back to the model they had been taught when they were freshmen, taking their first course in economics. And the answer given by that model is that if the economy is in recession or going into recession, the government should run deficits and increase the amount of its spending.
In other words, you know, more recently, we've adopted the Nixon, we're all Keynesians now mentality, and we forgot that that mentality produced the stagflation of the 1970s that caused us to move away from that type of thinking.
That's correct. And in terms of the Fed, the Fed has, of course, flooded the economy with an almost unthinkably huge amount of bank reserves, over $1 trillion, when bank reserves had never exceeded about $2 billion in our previous history. So now that the banks have this $1 trillion plus of excess reserves, reserves not required by their legal requirements, and this puts them in a position at the time they decide to begin making loans and investments, instead of sitting scared on top of this enormous pile of reserves, to bring about hyperinflation.
Well, you know, they're not actually sitting on the reserves. They are loaning the reserves to the U.S. government.
Well,
they're buying
true.
Treasuries. So
that's
what?
True.
So the key is going to be, because people say, well, they're just sitting on it. They're not doing anything with it. Yes, they are doing something with it. They're financing the deficit. But when they realize...
They're doing it for a return of 0.25%, and that is not the way to run a profitable business.
Well, they can do it now because they're borrowing from the Fed at practically zero, and they're reloaning to the Treasury at something above zero. But what the problem is going to be when they start to realize that after inflation, that's still a losing game, and once they start doing something else, now the question is, well, if the banks stop buying Treasuries, who's going to buy them? Well, and I think it's going to be the Fed.
That's most likely going to be the case, I think, that the Treasury is now relying more or less completely on the Fed to purchase additions to its debt, because I think the Chinese and the other big holders of U.S. Debt have been shrewd enough to realize that it would be stupid to accumulate any more of those securities, and so their tendency now is going to be to move in the opposite direction.
Yeah, well, I think that's the real reason behind QE2 is they're trying to rationalize why the Federal Reserve is going to be buying more debt. They don't want to say it's because we can't find demand for our bonds, so they want to make it act like it's an intentional policy to justify why the Fed is going to be buying such a large proportion of our debt.
Yeah, actually, in some of Bernanke's recent speeches, you can almost see him admitting that QE2 is not aimed at increasing the money stock, but rather at implementing a credit policy, directing credit in particular to the Treasury, but to some extent also directing credit to other parties.
Well, more amazing than that, he's actually said that the goal of QE2 is to cause the stock market to rise, so that we'll have higher wealth and that will generate more consumption, more spending. Yeah. In other words, he wants to create an asset bubble to replace the last asset bubble that the Fed created that just burst, which was inflated to solve the problems created by the previous asset bubble that the Fed inflated.
Yeah, it may be, depending on what one thinks about the stock prices right now, that he's seeking to create a bubble on a bubble.
Well, stock prices, I think, are still too high, and certainly our real estate prices. And again, the Fed is also trying to aim its monetary policy at real estate prices. And, you know, it's interesting because when real estate prices were rising, right, during the bubble, the Fed never looked at that as problematic and never tried to use higher interest rates as a tool to stop real estate prices from rising, but it's certainly trying to use the opposite to stop real estate prices from falling.
Yes, that's right. And so, that was part of the Fed's basic misunderstanding of what was going on, I think, Peter, that the Fed treated the trouble as if it had something to do with a shortfall of liquidity, when it had everything to do with insolvencies associated with people's making investments in the wrong assets.
Yeah. Now, you've taught economics at a number of universities, also here in the United States and outside the United States. I mean, when you're at these universities, I mean, are you finding yourself? I mean, are you at odds with everybody? Are you arguing with other members of the faculty? What's it like with the students? Because, I mean, it's very rare. I know when I was a student at UC Berkeley, I argued with everybody. And, you know, I guess everybody was a Keynesian except for me.
Well, there are people in academia who are not Keynesians, but the basic problem with academia is that the people who do economic theory there are just not intellectually serious. And by that I mean these people are puzzle solvers. They like to formulate new models that use some mathematics more advanced than the old models used, and if you do that repeatedly, you become a superstar of the economics profession. It's a kind of pyrotechnic show-off that passes for a high level of prowess among the academic economists. It's very much removed from reality, Peter. It's like living in the world that they create with their models.
And there's no – and the interesting thing about it, or not even maybe not interesting, kind of more pathetic, is that – no matter how often these things fail, it doesn't discredit them.
No,
they don't have. So there's no. They don't have to be accurate. It just has to be complex.
That's right. The failure actually presents a new opportunity for them to formulate a new model and move on to their next stage of greatness.
Yeah, and you know, my theory too behind a lot of it is that the whole profession is about justifying what politicians want to do anyway, which is spend more money to get elected. And so they like politicians that validate with some kind of economic rationale what they want to do, where they can actually say, printing money like with unemployment benefits. If we give more money to the unemployed, it's going to help the economy. So now they get to buy votes, and they actually think they're helping the economy, and the recipients of this government money think that they're helping the economy because they spend it.
Some economists are more or less running dogs for the government, but I think the basic problem in academia is less that than it is simply the removal of academic economic theory from the real world. The tendency of academic economists to impress their colleagues with more and more elaborate modeling and fancier and fancier mathematics really overrides everything else. And many of these people are not ideologues at all. They may be soft left in a way, but they're really overgrown nerds and geeks.
Yeah, and the amazing thing, too, is how they're able to rewrite history to actually blame the Depression on failures of free market capitalism and credit the Keynesian or socialist policies of Roosevelt as our savior, that he got us out of it, despite the fact that, you know, we didn't get out of it until after the Second World War. And a lot of people, and maybe you have an opinion here, a lot of people think the Second World War got us out of the Depression. I don't think we got out of the Depression until the war ended, and it was the ending of the war that created an economic boom.
I've actually been preaching that sermon for more than 30 years, Peter, and my book, Depression, War, and Cold War, goes into a lot of detail to provide evidence for that interpretation. I think the idea that almost all economists, as well as the general public, accept that the war got us out of the economy is just a big mistake. They just haven't thought through what they mean by getting out of the Depression. And what's happened is the fact that unemployment disappeared has been the main fact leading people to believe that, well, the war obviously ended the Depression. But what happened was that at one time or another during the war, 16 million men were brought into the armed forces, most of them by conscription. And if you draft some 20% of the labor force, that'll take care of 7 or 8% unemployment every time.
Right, but the question was, what did the American public gain from all that employment? Were living standards during the Second World War for those people who were at home, did they improve over the Great Depression? And you could argue in many cases that people had it tougher during the war than they did before the war.
Well, I think the average person had a deterioration of level of living after 1941 that did not recover until the end of the war. Now, there were a few people, like some of the blacks that migrated from the South to work in the northern factories, that probably improved their conditions. But the average person did not, because of rationing and restrictions on the production of durable consumer goods and all sorts of other things that kept people from enjoying a high standard of living during the war.
Right, and by the time the war ended and we demilitarized and we cut all that government spending and we forgot all that, you know, Keynesian nonsense, that's when we got the boom. But anyway, hold on. I want to talk anarchy as soon as we get back for the next segment, so don't go away.
Okay.
The Peter Schiff Show.
Since the Peter Schiff Show was last on the air, the national debt added another $7.89 million. Luckily, Peter's intelligence is growing twice as fast.
That's incredible.
Welcome back to your source of sanity in an insane world. It's the Peter Schiff Show.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Peter Schiff Show. With Robert Higgs as my guest. He is an economics professor and author, and we agree on just about everything, with maybe the one exception of the topic we're about to discuss, and that is anarchy. Now, you know, ideally, I would be an anarchist, right? I would love to have no government, but I think that's idealistic. I think in reality, I think it's impossible. I think anarchy is kind of like a vacuum, and government is going to be created on its own to fill that void. I think that society, individuals are always going to band together in some way to protect themselves from criminals. And the minute you do that, the minute you create something, you've created a government. And my thing is that, well, instead of letting something be formed on its own that might be even more destructive, let's preempt it. Since we know there's going to be a government of some form, let's create one and dramatically limit its power so that we prevent a more destructive government from forming on its own. Anyway, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that limited government is the utopian option, Peter. This is something that people have written about and talked about for centuries, but the actual experience has been that limited government never remains limited.
That is the problem, that government usurps power. But where is there a situation where you can have no government and it's going to stay that way? I mean, is there a precedent for a society saying we're going to have no government and then a government never forms?
Well, we don't have a lot of good historical precedents except among isolated or primitive societies for places that had no government for a long time. But I think we need to draw a distinction between the inevitability of government and the desirability of government in its current form.
Well, in its current form, I mean, you know, even what Thomas Jefferson says at best, right, government is a necessary evil, even in its best sense. But in its worst, it's an intolerable one. And I think we have certainly arrived at that definition and that, you know, I would prefer anarchy to what we've got right now. But the question is, anarchy won't last that long. And the whole concept of a government that is severely limited in power by a strong constitution. And of course, our founding fathers, you know, they feared government. They feared democracy. They thought that they had solved the problem by creating a republic that kept the evil forces of democracy in check and where the government was giving very limited and clearly defined powers. And it worked very well for a while. I mean, even though the government did encroach on some of those powers and usurp some over time, I mean, with that experiment, America came from nowhere to be the richest, most powerful country the world has ever seen because we succeeded more than other nations in limiting the power of our government.
Well, but we're now losing that advantage, Peter.
Well, we have. I agree.
We've just about sold our heritage out completely in terms of limited government.
Well, no.
The government we have in this country today is verging on a complete police state.
Well, I agree. We have. There's nothing the government can't do. There are no constitutional restraints. We have an omnipotent government. We have the antithesis of what the founding fathers envisioned. Oh, yeah, I don't support this, but I don't think that we can have no government at all.
What is important to remember in discussing this is not that people will have no government. People want rules. They want the enforcement of property rights and other aspects of public order. But the question is whether governments will be monopolies. It's monopoly government that becomes tyrannical. And that's what we have in this country. There are alternative ways to structure government. But right now, so many people have been brought up, indoctrinated by public education, by the media, and by other outlets to believe that government as it currently exists is the only form
of
government.
Oh, no. We agree 100%. In fact, I think we'd be better off if we were still governed under the Articles of Confederation and had no federal government at all.
Well, that would certainly be a big advantage because there was no tax power there.
Yeah, and initially, you know, the founding fathers didn't even want to give the federal government the power to tax. The only reason they got it was because of wartime. It was like, well, they might need taxes if there's a war. But they didn't even envision any taxes at all on the federal level in peacetime.
War always turns out to be the killer of liberty.
Absolutely. Anyway, we're running out of time. Do you want to stick around into the next segment? If not, I would really appreciate you being on the show.
I'm afraid I must go now, Peter, but I appreciate you having me on today.